Angie Cha was born in Vietnam. She earned a BA in Southeast Asian Culture and Political Economy from UC Berkeley and a master's degree in English with a creative writing emphasis from UC Davis, where she was a fiction editor for the Greenbelt Review. In 2009, she won the UC Davis Maurice Prize in Fiction. Her debut story collection, Quiet As They Come, was released by IG Publishing in 2010. Angie, welcome to New America Now.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. I read somewhere that you were a boat person. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience.
I probably would have to tell you, in retrospect, through stories that I've been retold from mm-hmm. my parents, because I was so young. I think I was 3 and a half. Mm-hmm. But I do have these images of leaving in the middle of the night. And I remember the pier and the docks and all of these people I'd never seen before and being scared mm-hmm. because there were people who were amputees and so forth, just lining the streets by the ferry or under the ships that we embarked on. And I do remember being at the refugee camp in Malaysia. And it's funny because in telling it, it sounds so dramatic and extreme, but actually my memories are kind of sweet memories of going swimming every day and my dad teaching us, all the kids, how to swim and, I don't know, like trying to make kites and all the women gambling and, you know, for Coca-Cola. And so, and then that's what I essentially remember.
And then you resettled in the Bay Area.
Yes.
What is that experience like to go from the refugee camp and then find yourself in a completely different place and strange?
I think it was a combination of being both jarring and also that wide-eyed wonder that I think is quite wonderful, because as an adult, you get used to things and you're waiting like, okay, what else is new? You know, what else can you show me? But I remember that very pivotal slice of life where we first arrived. And for me, what was very different was that, you know, I'm an only child. And growing up, when I was in Saigon, I had my mom, dad, and a nanny or two. And then all of a sudden, we were all under one roof with a family in each bedroom. And so having all of these other kids, all my cousins to play with for an entire year and a half, that was really fun.
Well, in Quiet As They Come, there is a built-in tension between parents and children. The parents, the adults in the families, tend to be very harsh with reality, full of warnings and lessons to be learned. And yet the children all tend to gravitate toward the larger America and the freedom that promised outside of the home. And talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that that is a somewhat inherent pattern to the immigrant experience, where the older generation, their lives have been turned upside down as a result of war and things that are simply hard. And so in arriving to a new country, it's all about trying to build a foundation of stability. You know, you risked your life to come here. Now you want your children to succeed. And I think there's less room for taking risks and embracing this new world, because if you're the adult, you just want your kids to be safe. You want to make sure that people get from A to B in time and safely, and they get grades and so forth. Whereas I think for the younger generation, myself, my cousins, and therefore these characters in the story collection, we don't always have this old world to constantly compare to. All we have is this new world that we want to embrace and we want to explore.
And part of that wanting to embrace turned you into a writer. How does your family feel about it? Because, again, I understand immigrants, Asian and Vietnamese families, tend to be very reluctant to see their children become artists.
Right. Well, I think that my mom sums it up. And even after I found out that my book was getting bought and was to be published, she said, you know, well, remember, you have your left hand and you have your right hand. And so, which meant, you know, you have your left hand, which is that creative side and that artistic expression side, but you have your right hand, which means stick and continue with your day job, which I'm coming from my day job, as I sit across from you now.
Yeah. So there is always the practicality to weigh against the artistic impulse.
Yes. Yes.
How is it for someone like you to live in a very, Vietnamese situation and yet embrace a larger mainstream culture? How do you navigate between your own private culture and that of mainstream? I mean, I myself always have to figure out in the family, my parents don't want me to look at them in the eye. But in school, you know, the teachers, if you don't look at them in the eye and they think you're disrespectful, you have something to hide.
Yeah. No, I think it's a constant navigation. And I think that's what we have to deal with day in and day out. And I have a friend who's a high school teacher who recently told me there's a word for it. It's called code shifting or something, because she teaches in Oakland in the inner city, and there are lots of students from all over the world. And she was talking about how there are studies that say the ones who are best at quote unquote code shifting, who can, you know, their family might be from Ghana, and then they come to school and all of a sudden they have to adapt whatever it is, this urban culture and so forth. And it's the ones that can do that shifting back and forth that end up being most successful, because it's about being able to read nonverbal cues from people, or whether it's, you know, that taking on a different language set or slang to fit in. I think that's something that we always do.
How much of that plays into the way you write your stories?
It plays into the story in that I'm constantly imagining and putting myself in the shoes of the younger person, the newer generation, versus putting myself in the shoes of the older generation, and how would they view this exact situation. So the story collection, they're linked short stories. So a main character in one story may become a secondary character in another story, and you keep on seeing these people pop up, you know, chronologically throughout the years. And I hope that that's what the work as a whole attempts to look at, which is one situation from varying angles and how it's like putting a crystal to the light, and it just reflects everywhere, and everyone has their own worldview, so to speak.
Well, I noticed that one of the biggest differences between the older and younger generation is the way they approach sex. I mean, sex for the young seems to be exuberant and full of desires, and, you know, and yet the old, you know, they have their own problem, but they try to hide it. And I'd like to hear more about sex, if you please.
Well, I think that is somewhat true, although I would invite you to read the passage in the story The Pussycats when Kim is reminiscing about, you know, her honeymoon in Dalat, and she's under a canopy of pines, and she has all of these preset expectations because she got married as a virgin, and about what her wedding night would be and how she would consummate her marriage. And it doesn't actually happen on the night of the wedding, because she has all these ridiculous barriers, you know, and preconceived notions. And then they end up, you know, having sex, making love beneath the trees, standing up, and I think is a very raw and animal. And yet she's of the older generation.
Sure. But the younger generation tend to use sex as a challenge to the older generation. And in one of the pieces you wrote, there's a scene in which the daughter, Michelle, straddles a stranger before the mother walks in. So, I mean, that is a difference between the mother and daughter. Of course, the parents have sex, but the children have sex almost as a way to say, I'm American.
Right. Yeah. And it's this in your face act of rebellion, and as rebellious as you can imagine being, particularly from that Vietnamese vantage point. Right. I don't know that I actually set out to make a statement about sex in the younger generation versus the older generation. I think that I was just writing stories that felt honest, that felt fun, and that's where it wanted to lead, in a sense.
Well, it's inevitable when you write about young teen, American teenagers right. that sex will play itself
exactly.
in.
Exactly, exactly.
But what is it like to be almost the second generation of Vietnamese-American writers? In a sense that for the last 10, 15 years, there's been a crop of writers from our community, Vietnamese-American community. And for people like me who sort of been at the forefront of it, we had no models, we had no examples. You know, and it was sort of like walking in the dark about creating right. your own path.
Right.
But do you feel that it's too crowded now for you? Or how does it feel to have so many Vietnamese-American writers on the scene suddenly?
No, I mean, I think it's great. I think it's a complex story. And everyone has their own viewpoint and slice to share. And I don't see people saying, oh, there are too many Jewish writers and Jewish American stories, and now it's getting crowded. Or, oh gosh, I mean, we already have Toni Morrison, and we already mm-hmm. have Alice Walker, and then we already have, yeah. you know, all of these African American writers, and yeah. it's too crowded. I think it's America, so to speak. And I didn't have an English lit background, but I studied a lot, and I started writing this book 10 years ago. And when I was embarking on it, I felt like I knew of Vietnamese writers who had been translated, like Dương Thư Hương or Binh Dinh,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't really aware of Vietnamese American writers writing as much. I think fiction in particular, and I think it's been amazing to see and learn and feel this thriving community and have a dialogue. It's nice to have a dialogue that feels relevant and have people concerned about what one is concerned with, mm-hmm. with interesting viewpoints that sometimes differ.
Sometimes I notice that, and it's maybe true with other community too, is that when your story is too true, it's not as popular as when your story is written a way to cater to a larger audience. You know, if you have a sort of a 40-something female Caucasian imagination of another place, somehow that becomes more popular than something as tedious as the suffering of your own people,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I find that to be true, not just a story written in print, but also in movies.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that? You know, there is a price to pay for being authentic.
Perhaps there is a price for being authentic, but I think, like you mentioned, because I was at your reading, you said that when you plow the depths of your soul for the stuff that's the gritty, honest, hard truth, that's where the universality lies, because it's the human condition. And I think that that is most interesting and most true. So those who are more, I guess, fascinated by the stereotype of what they may imagine Vietnam to be, whether it's, you know, like palm trees and mangoes and, you know, beautiful girls in white ao yai strolling through the streets and the colonial homes, you know, that's certainly there, but that is, it's so topical, surfacey, and I think it's a bore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's so much more beneath that layer. And that's where I wanted to get at both the Vietnam side of things and both what it means to be a person in the modern world who happens to have been from Vietnam, trying to make it and find their way in this complicated, complex, messy urban environment of San Francisco.
Yeah.
I think that's more interesting.
Sure, I agree. and I enjoy your book a lot, but I just want to know, how difficult has it been to try to capture that difficulty and translating it to a larger audience outside of your own community?
I think two things. When I sit down to write, I want to write stories that ring true to me, stories that I think will entertain, like something that I would read and entertain others. And then layered on top of that, the part about reaching out to a wider audience, I guess that didn't really resonate, or I didn't make it a point to take that into consideration in the writing process. But on top of that, the only time that it would come up was there were moments when I would you know, workshop a story in my writing program, and the way a character was treated. I would, for example, have a very strong female protagonist, and my audience, my cohort, who are all just really bright, really kind people and earnest people, would say things like, oh, well, I think that that mom is way too Americanized and westernized because she actually talked back to her husband. And I thought, you know, Vietnamese and Asian people are very submissive. And I had to say, well, it's just clearly not true, because in my family, the women are dominant, you know, and my mom was a business owner and a pharmacist. My aunt was a banker. And in our house, they run the finances. And there's all this stuff that has to do with, you know, Vietnamese culture and so forth. But I felt like, how do you get it on the page so that the character is true to the character while almost having to fight against these preconceived notions that the larger public has of your culture? And how do you do it without having to write an entire character sketch before you introduce the character, right? So how do you show it so that it rings true in gesture and nuance and dialogue that she is a strong woman with a steely backbone, and it doesn't mean that she's Americanized?
Yeah. It's a challenge, all right. I understand that a few of your characters will live on in another book. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's a character named Kim, who is a single mom who has to raise her two kids on her own after arriving by boat and so forth in San Francisco. And her husband is Duke, and he was a high-ranking officer in the South Vietnamese Army who ends up becoming a POW. So they're separated because he's imprisoned, and 10 years pass before they even get reunited again. And these two characters pop up in three, four different stories in the 11-story collection. And even though I gave them so much time and space in these pages, there was something about their story in particular that just kept on scratching at me and, you know, kind of whispering in my ear that there was so much more to explore with this very complex relationship, this tumultuous relationship, this love story, so to speak. And so now I'm writing a novel that gets to explore that. And what's been great about it is the research that I get to do about Vietnam during, you know, in the pre-war years, during the war, and then also the expansiveness of the novel form, getting so much room to breathe almost after writing short stories for the last 10 years.
Well, congratulations on everything, and best of luck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Angie Chow is the author of Quiet As They Come.